And now it's time for this week's Something Understood. In a special edition of the programme, Mark Tully talks to the Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, about understanding prayer.
Russian Orthodox hymn, Let My Prayer Arise, introducing an Anglican prelate much influenced also by Orthodox Christianity, a poet and a scholar, the Most Reverend and Right Honourable Rowan Williams, who was enthroned as Archbishop of Canterbury in 2003. We spoke together in the crypt chapel of his official London residence, Lambeth Palace, on the south bank of the Thames. During the stormy 6 years he's been the most senior clergyman of the Church of England, Rowan Williams has faced criticism on many fronts. He's been accused of vacillating on the question of homosexuality, dangerous views on Sharia law, and naive opinions on economic issues. But the Archbishop confounded those who criticised him for weak leadership of the Anglican Communion when, at the end of last summer's Lambeth Conference of Bishops from around the world, he received a spontaneous standing ovation. And he's won almost universal respect for his courage and calm in facing criticism, his profound learning and his deep faith. In an article in the New Statesman, James McIntyre said, Rowan Williams is marked by a rare humility and even that most elusive of qualities, holiness. Prayer is at the centre of his life. And at the end of his book, Tokens of Trust, the Archbishop quotes from the Sonnet Prayer, written by the 17th century Welsh Anglican priest George Herbert. God's breath in man returning to his birth, the soul's blood, the land of spices, something understood. And those words, Rowan Williams says, tell him what he is secretly and slowly acclimatizing himself to. They're also the words our title was derived from when these programs started 14 years ago. So I thought I should talk to the Archbishop about prayer and asked him first what traditions nurtured his prayer life.
I suppose that it began really with a fairly traditional Book of Common Prayer Anglican identity, which I was learning when I was a teenager, although I'd grown up in another atmosphere. That was what I was familiar with in my early teens.
Was there anything particularly Welsh in it?
The tradition of Welsh hymn singing, of course, was part of my, well, I could almost say mother's milk. You know, it was what I absorbed when I was very young, and that's always meant a lot. Music as part of worship certainly started there, and that's always been central for me. And both in the way I approach music and the way I approach worship, there's a crossover.
Oh!
one of the Archbishop's favourite Welsh hymns, Jesus, Jesus, All Sufficient. When Rowan Williams was at Oxford, he was much influenced by Eastern Orthodox Christianity, an influence which grew from attending his first Orthodox service when he was a teenager.
There was something rather different, a bigger dimension. And the evening after I'd been to that liturgy, I can remember saying my evening prayers as usual, and suddenly knowing I wanted to spend longer with it and be more quiet and just absorb what I'd received. And then a bit later on, reading some very good books by a couple of modern Roman Catholic writers like Christopher Butler. So that's where the groundwork was laid, I think, in those years.
So how do you understand what you're actually doing when you're praying?
As a Christian, my understanding is that what I'm doing is allowing the life of Jesus to come alive in me through the Holy Spirit, which means that from the depth of my being as a believer, there rises up a kind of a welling up of life and love directed towards that mysterious source of Jesus' being, which we call God the Father. So when I pray, I'm trying to make room for that. I'm not trying to fill up the space. I'm not trying to do something, but almost to be carried on that rising water. The four quartets, Eliot's four quartets, the pool was filled with water out of silence. It's a beautiful image. And that sense of something rising up. But for that to happen, you have to let go of a lot. You have to still your body and your imagination and let something flower, let something happen. And your mind and your feelings sooner or later have to get out of the way. So prayer is communion. It's that allowing, as again somebody said, the depth within, the depth outside to come together.
How do you feel about intercessory prayer? Because yours is very much internal prayer in a way, isn't it?
There's no huge difference, really. There was a phrase I came across years ago by a great Church of England writer of the 20th century who, writing to a friend, said, I'm going to spend 10 minutes just thinking about you and Jesus. And I thought, that's a brilliant definition of intercessory prayer. You don't send in your list of requests. You don't bombard God with your demands. You just hold the image, the sense of a person or a situation in the presence of God, as if you want to let the one seep into the other, bring those two realities together in your mind and heart. And that's very much how I find intercession works.
So there isn't any element really of saying to God, please help this person, or please let this happen.
Well, of course there is, because your emotions are involved here, and in particularly intense circumstances of need, of course I say sometimes, God, please make a difference to this. But the bottom line, the thing that goes on, is just holding them there. Your emotions push you towards saying these things, and no need to be ashamed of that. But the reality is just letting God into the situation, as it were.
You've tucked this interview into a very, very busy schedule. How do you find time to pray and to be quiet in this life that you're living?
One of the most sobering things I've ever heard on this is Archbishop Desmond Tutu saying to somebody once, I'm too busy to pray for less than 2 hours a day. And I'm still thinking about that, but what he clearly meant was the busier it gets, the more essential it is to make the space. Because simply going from one thing to the next, if you haven't tried to put down an anchor somewhere, then you will really be exhausted and distracted. It's bad enough as it is, but it's a matter of trying to make time early in the morning to put the whole day in perspective and have enough space then to frame the rest of the day, but also simply making the most of those rare moments where nothing much is going on, to settle, physically settle, breathe from the pit of your stomach for a few minutes, perhaps let a word or two come, Jesus, God. Just be there, because as you'll know as well as I, the great temptation is not being there. It's having your energies, your imagination, always somewhere where you're not actually present. So being with God is settling in the moment. And when people talk about the absence of God in prayer, I've occasionally said to people, the problem isn't the absence of God, it's the absence of you. R.S. Thomas wrote a number of poems about prayer, and they're mostly to do with waiting, with silence, with a sense of the absence of God, and yet in the middle of that awareness of absence, realizing, well, you have arrived, there is a reality, and it's beyond the words you can find, and so you've got to wait, you've got to stay with it.
He kneeled down, dismissing his orisons as inappropriate. One by one they came to his lips and were swallowed, but without bile. He fell back on an old prayer. Teach me to know what to pray for. He listened. After the weather of his asking, no still, small voice, only the parade of ghosts, casualties of his past intercessions. He held out his hands, cupped as though to receive blood leaking from life's side. They remained dry, as his mouth did. But the prayer formed. Deliver me from the long drought of the mind. Let leaves from the deciduous cross fall on us, washing us clean, turning our autumn to gold by the affluence of their fountain.
Another Welsh Anglican priest, R.S. Thomas's poem, The Prayer. The Archbishop himself stands in a long line of poet priests. So, is there a particular relationship between poetry and prayer?
I'm sure that there is. And I think it's very much to do with this business of trying to get out of the way of what's happening, trying to get the managing, fussy mind out of the way. Poetry happens in some ways unexpectedly. Something clicks, something comes together, there's a convergence that you weren't looking for. And then the writing of the poem is exploring that sudden coming together that you hadn't expected. But to be in the frame of mind where these little comings together happen, you need a bit of a habit of quiet, a bit of a habit of listening, letting things happen. And I find that the kind of inner disposition that helps poetry happen is not a million miles from the inner disposition that helps prayer happen. Bach's cello suites are, for me, I suppose, the supreme example of contemplation in music. They don't deal with the emotions very much. Nothing spectacular. It's a single line just unfolding itself. And I always see it as a kind of silver line in the middle of darkness. And its effect is just to bring you into that darkness with a sense of self-awareness and being drawn into an unfolding pattern that just is itself. And that, for me, is the contemplative mystery, that you are just drawn into something that is itself.
The opening movement of Bach's first cello suite. For his Lent reading this year, the Archbishop chose a book written by Timothy Radcliffe, the former master of the worldwide Roman Catholic Dominican Order. The book was called Why Go to Church? And I wondered what answer the Archbishop would give to that question.
Church, organized traditional church, gives you a framework of understanding, and it gives you a vocabulary. It tells you what kind of God you're involved with, a God who is not distant and to be shouted at, but a God who has made himself utterly accessible. It tells you that you have the possibility of standing in God's presence and addressing God as Jesus did, that is, intimately, directly, from within God's own life. And it also gives you this sort of repertoire of phrases and rhythms, which, when things are difficult or dry in your prayer, you can turn to. Are you finding it hard to concentrate, to focus? Well, find a phrase, find a form of words, and, as it were, hang the silence on that peg. Because words that are familiar, that you don't have to think about intensely, help you circle round and settle down. It's, you know, it's like the dog walking round in a circle and finally settling on the floor. You need the words to guide you in that. So when I was a teenager, I remember one of the little books of prayer I was given by my vicar had the general confession from the prayer book. We give thee most humble and hearty thanks for all thy goodness and loving kindness to us and to all men. We bless thee for our creation, preservation, and all the blessings of this life. And I learned that by heart as a boy. And it's still there. And at moments, it's, you know, it's the peg to hang things on. And whether it's hymns or the words of prayer, it really helps to have those little formula that sometimes just quiet your mind. So all of that is part of what you derive as an individual from going to church. But also, and you know, this is rather bluntly put, but as a Christian, you're always praying with other Christians, whether you realize it or not. You go to church in order to, once again, to immerse yourself in something, to absorb something and be absorbed, to pray as we say in the church, as the body of Christ, as that community which together articulates Christ's love and longing for God the Father.
You must hear a lot of people criticizing the church and saying that it doesn't do anything to help you pray. How do you answer that criticism?
Well,
you must get fed up with that.
Well, I do in one sense, but I also recognize how true it is, because a lot of churches that I find myself in, I think, oh, for goodness sake, just shut up for a moment. Let God in. This is so noisy, so confident and busy that nobody's really going to have space to grow in this. And I think we ought to be working much more carefully about how we structure our prayer around quiet, how the rhythms actually, again, bring people to where they are, instead of just pushing them into a sort of hectic pattern of feeling and chattering again. We're not good at it. And I think unless we can somehow imagine afresh our shared worship, well, then, you know, it won't be surprising if individuals go away feeling they've not really been helped to grow, been helped to move into something deeper and more silent and more real.
Herbert Howell's Annus Dei, or Lamb of God, from his setting of the Anglican Office of Holy Communion. Rowan Williams was on the 21st floor of a building just south of the World Trade Center on 9/11. The building was so near the Twin Towers that it rocked when the first tower disintegrated. The group he was with only escaped with the greatest difficulty, almost suffocating on smoke and soot. How did the Archbishop pray, facing what was a very real threat of death?
In the middle of it all, I have a couple of memories that have stuck with me. One is of gathering the people who were in the building I was in when we thought it might go down with the others, and just the 30 or so of us in a darkened room because the lights had gone out, listening to the noise of one of the towers coming down, and all of us trying to focus our prayers, just, you know, holding hands and breathing, and they asked me to lead them in prayer. And it was the challenge of holding that stillness in the middle of real panic, which I think was a reminder that in the most extreme of situations, human beings still have some capacity to arrive, to be where they are. And then the second experience that day, unforgettable, was when we were trying to get away from the sort of rush of debris as the second tower came down, and we took refuge in a little porter cabin. Again, a group of us had come out together. We had with us a group of very distressed preschool children as well, who'd been at a creche in the same building. We were getting them away with us. And there was a workman there in the porter cabin who didn't know who we were and just said, "Hey, I'm a Christian and I think we ought to pray." And just put his arms around some of us and gathered us all into a big kind of football scrum and prayed very directly and honestly and intently. And again, looking back on that, I felt, out of all the fear and the panic, come these very plain words. That chap wouldn't have known about it, but I thought of what the writer of The Cloud of Unknowing in the Middle Ages says. When you're in a burning house, you say fire. When you're in the middle of darkness and difficulty, you say God.
How important do you think it is that believers in different faiths should pray together?
I find myself quite often sharing silence with people from other faith traditions, because as soon as you start trying to find words that you can share, you're into the conflict area. David Scott's poem about three figures, one Christian, one Jewish, one Muslim, is a beautiful little image of how somehow in the attempt to be open to God, you can arrive at a place where all of you together are, in his image, served by the reality. He has this picture of the little Nazarene, the unobtrusive little figure of Jesus, who somehow belongs in all these worlds, coming and serving each one together. And when I think of the tensions and struggles between the three traditions, I find an image like that really helps. Are we ready to be served by the reality we talk about?
All three went to paradise, Ibn Abad, Rabbi Schmelke of Nikolsburg, and Father Louis, and sat to eat at the same table. They drank the water of life and ate the meat of friendship. Whenever their cups ran dry or their plates were empty, a little Nazarene came by and filled them up. "Who are you?" they said. "I am Jesus, son of Mary. Can I sit a while?" "Be our guest," they said. As they sat, the ground beneath them shook. Their faces paled and their eyes were filled with knowledge and with grief. "Today," said Jesus, "they will hate more and love more than on any other day since the world began. Hold hands and ask our God to speak to us in spirit." And there they sat, in love and prayer, all day. All day, Ibn Abad, Rabbi Schmelke of Nikolsburg, Father Louis, and Jesus, Mary's son. And their silence was more profound than words, and their communion was most eloquent, and they willed the world to peace.
Ibn Abad woke early, a poem written following 9/11 by the poet-priest David Scott. And now, from the events of 9/11, which reverberated around the world and are still reverberating, to a purely personal question, one I wasn't quite sure I should ask.
What would you say to someone like me, then, who has to admit that I'm not very good at saying my prayers?
First, I'd say I'd be very suspicious of anybody who said they were very good at saying their prayers. Very
That's
suspicious.
That's encouraging to me, then.
Because, you know, speaking as someone else who's not very good at saying their prayers, I'd say the point of it all is prayer is allowing truth and reality to flower in you, and therefore it's part of becoming more human, more yourself. The point of it is not to get easily tabulated results. The point is to grow into truth. Even the smallest bit of openness and silence and welcome to God is part of that. One great writer of the 20th century said, the less you pray, the worse it goes, and that's certainly true. At the same time, if you have 5 minutes, then you have 5 minutes, and you give that to God and you say, make me truer, make me more real, make me more loving. And God does astonishing things with the small opportunities we give him.
Thank you very much, Archbishop.
The Archbishop has said that when he prays, he's not trying to do something, and he's certainly not telling God what to do or what he wants him to do. He's trying to be with God to let things happen. And although, with the humility that he's known for, Rowan Williams says he's not very good at praying, prayer has given him the strength to survive the criticism, the lack of understanding, and at times the downright hostility which has assailed him. And he hasn't just survived, he's avoided anger and bitterness, and remained at peace with himself and his critics. So, perhaps it's not surprising that he chose to end our conversation with a composition which tells him that beyond loss there is truth and life.
Piece, Tarleton's Resurrection, I've always loved because it's a profoundly simple little tune which somehow expresses in a very short space pathos and loss and hope. It deals with that sense of, yes, there's a death, there's a sorrow here. It's a lament for a dead clown who was a great theatrical performer in the Elizabethan age, and then rises very simply into a resolution that says beyond loss is truth and life.
Tarleton's Resurrection, ending this week's special edition of Something Understood. The programme was presented by Mark Tully and produced by Ellie McCange, with readings by Frank Sterling and David Westhead. Something Understood is a unique production for BBC Radio 4.